Well, I'm delighted to welcome on the line now from United States of America, George Leopold, talking about his book, Calculated Risk. Good afternoon, George. How are you?
Good, Dave. Good to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you on. Whereabouts in the States are you? Like, always like to know.
Say again?
Whereabouts in the States are you in the U.S.?
I'm in the Washington, D.C. suburbs of Northern Virginia, very close to all of the historic sites of the space race.
I've still got to come and visit. I really have. Well, it's great to have you on. It really is, George. And I suppose right starting off from the get-go here, Gus Grissom is not a name which I was familiar with, and yet there's so many other astronauts that I'm familiar with. Why would that be?
Well, Gus was one of the early Mercury astronauts, and part of it was he was quiet, circumspect. He was an engineering test pilot, didn't like to toot his own horn, and he flew on sort of a fluke of the missions. His flight was an engineering test flight. You know, we tend to remember Alan Shepard and John Glenn. Well, Gus was remembered largely for losing his first spacecraft when the hatch accidentally blew. And then he sort of quietly worked in the background, made his way back, and of course ended up getting the maiden flights of two spacecraft before his tragic death in 1967. So the Apollo narrative is there's this fire, and then after the fire, we get to the moon, and many of Gus's contributions are sort of lost in all of that.
How far back do you go with this? I mean, did he have any indications that he was going to be? I mean, a lot of boys want to be an astronaut, don't they? when they get older, was that the case?
Yeah, it was sort of the usual thing. You know, back in the '30s, these kids, especially American kids in the American Midwest, were just captivated by Charles Lindbergh and all these guys flying around the world, breaking all of these aviation records. They all made the balsa wood airplanes and so forth. But I think Gus, he knew he wanted to fly at a young age. He got into World War II too late to go to pilot school. But, you know, like a lot of these guys, they wanted to go fast and they wanted to go higher. And ultimately, if he became an astronaut, the farthest place to go was the moon. So,
it's no mean feat, is it, to make it as an astronaut to get through the training and to reach that criteria?
Would he have to go through? You mean?
Yes, to actually arrive and to get to that position in life. I mean, it must have been quite an achievement for him.
Yeah, right. And of course, the key thing was Gus flew in Korea, 100 combat missions. He re-upped for 25 more, but they sent him home to train pilots, which turned out to be almost as dangerous as combat. And then a lot of these guys followed the same career path. They became test pilots. And of course, in 1947, Chuck Yeager breaks the sound barrier. So there's all of this aviation research going on in the U.S., of course, in the U.K. and across Europe as well. And these guys become test pilots. And then one day we form this space agency. In fact, this week is NASA's 60th anniversary. And this is all in response to Sputnik. And they decide who are the best candidates to be astronauts. Well, it turns out it's test pilots, and Gus was one of about 160 who was called in to decide whether they wanted to participate in this thing called Project Mercury. And he answered the call, made the cut, and eventually became one of America's first astronauts.
And now, for the book, you have interviewed lots of his friends around him, colleagues and so on. Of course, because you can't interview the man himself, he never wrote the memoirs, never got a chance to do that like many did. But from what you've learned from this, we're talking about a different time now, aren't we? And how much would they, as astronauts, been aware of the kind of grander scheme of things as far as the race to the moon and the Cold War and the kind of context to his journey?
Right. Yeah, well, Gus and a lot of these early pioneers, you know, they didn't think of themselves as being heroes.
No.
But they did consider themselves to be pioneers, and they understood that, you know, the president, JFK, had said, we're going to go to the moon by the end of the decade. well, these guys are some of the most highly competitive people on Earth, and they want to beat the then Soviet Union. And then I think certainly in Gus's case, you know, he didn't like the attention. He didn't call attention to himself. He didn't care about parades and the White House ceremonies, but he did want to get to the moon before the Russians. And he put all of his effort and, you know, a great sacrifice to his family into this effort to get to the moon. And, you know, if things had worked out, it's possible Gus could have been the first man on the moon instead of Neil Armstrong. But, of course, he didn't make it. But because of his work and his sacrifice, we did make it. And, you know, that's sort of one of the great paradoxes of the space race, this cruel irony that if not for the fire, the United States probably doesn't get to the moon before the end of the decade, because the evidence of what had happened was there on the launch pad.
How close, I mean, I'm not sure if you go into this in the book, but from your knowledge, how close was the race between Moscow and Washington when it comes to getting on the moon?
Well, in the early years, the Russians were well ahead of us. They had bigger rockets. They could put a larger payload into space. We had done a lot of, you know, work with the X-15 and other these space planes and so forth. But the Russians were audacious. They put up the first satellite, Sputnik. I think shocked the world. You can't overstate the impact of Sputnik. And then of course Yuri Gagarin becomes the first human to fly in space. So they had many manned space firsts before us, and we were way behind. We did not catch up until the second of the two American space programs, which was called Gemini, two-man spacecraft. And during that program, which Gus Grissom played a key role in terms of design and so forth, we caught up. We finally caught up with the Soviets in our ability to actually fly a spacecraft, change its orbit, rendezvous and docking, walking in space, all of the things you need to do to get to the moon.
Yeah. The irony is, like you say, that he sacrificed a lot, and you just kind of mentioned his family situation. These guys, the amount of time that has to go into this to get it right, and the risk that they're taking. You mentioned that he sacrificed his family time. Is that something that he would have regretted, do you think?
Yeah, I think he may have. You know, the reality is that just about all of the early astronauts ended up divorced, including Neil Armstrong. Gus's son, Mark, said that in the last year of his life, Gus was maybe home about 6 weeks. I mean, this is all-consuming. It was actually life and death, as it turned out. And the early Apollo spacecraft was a mess. Well, one of the early designers said if it had been a horse, they would have shot it in 1966. But Gus thought he could fly it. You know, these guys, their attitude was, we can fly the crate that the thing came in. We're going to fix this, and we're going to go, and we're going to beat the Russians. And, you know, that was, they all sort of followed Gus's lead. Gus rolled up his sleeves. He spent long hours in the factory, and he tried to make this thing work. But he also understood the longer you're on the flight line, the better the chances are you're going to, as they said back then, buy the farm.
Now, how much was Gus and others around him aware of the dangers of what they were about to do? And was it an everyday acknowledgement, you know, this, we're risking our lives by doing this, or was it that they had the confidence in the technology to look after them?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, my thesis was that, of course, the book title, Calculated Risk, that you have to buy into a certain amount of risk in an inherently dangerous activity. And, you know, the idea of a test pilot is not that you're flying by the seat of your pants. In fact, it's trying to minimize risk as much as possible so that when, you know, the one thing you didn't think of happens, then you can deal with it. So, you know, I think that's the case with something like Apollo 13. They had anticipated so many things, something bad happened, and they figured out how to get three men back. And I think this was Gus's ethic.
And he never got to walk on the moon, as you say, and
Right.
You alluded earlier on to really his legacy was that moon landing. In what way, in layman's terms for people like me, would you say that what he did helped that to happen?
Well, again, I think it was the long hours out in California testing these machines, some of the most complicated machines ever built, you know, tens of thousands of components, and they've all got to work. And he spent many, many hours in trainers and simulators making sure that these machines work, because he brought this engineering expertise to the space program. He was by far, I think, the best engineering astronaut we ever had, and this had a profound impact on the younger guys who followed. In fact, the guys who ended up making the lunar landings, they saw that Gus was rolling up his sleeves. If they had boring testing to do, he joined in with them, because it sort of taught these guys this engineering ethic that was required to make all of this happen.
Mm.
They were inventing technologies as they went along.
Now, and I know, George, that you've been writing about science and, in particular, space flight and astronauts for a long time. But do you still get a bit excited when you get the opportunity to speak to astronauts and NASA engineers again? Because you must glean a lot from these guys who have experienced such a great thing.
Yeah, I think I'm sort of like a whole generation of American boys who watch this, that all of these things happen on live television and inspired us. I mean, Neil Armstrong said that he was always struck by the fact that how many people would come up to him and say, you know, what you did really inspired me to pursue a career in engineering or in science. And, you know, in my case, it turned out to be science writing.
Yeah.
I did have the pleasure of meeting Mike Collins, who was on the first lunar landing mission. Probably one of the most erudite persons to ever fly in space. Great sense of humor, great guy, and you know, we were just really fortunate to have people so competent and wise flying to the moon. It was quite a time. I think Apollo was one of the great organizing principles in human history.
And Gus as a person, an everyday guy, what was it? What was he like? What were the people talking lovingly about him, those that knew him?
In terms of Gus?
Yeah, personality and character and so on.
I mean, fun-loving. His brother Lowell described him as a moderate extrovert. You know, he didn't call attention to himself. He had a sharp sense of humor. He enjoyed a good joke. He worked hard. He played hard. And I think he probably would be embarrassed by the fuss that's being made over him these days. But, you know, my goal was to make sure that everybody understood his contributions, and we don't get to the moon without what Gus Grissom did for the country and the world.
Absolutely, and it impacted the world as well. I mean, I wasn't around in that era. I was born in 76, but it's impacted the UK and Europe and the rest of the world in such a way, and so much so that I suppose the final question today, George, is do you foresee a time where space travel will be on the agenda again? Because it seems to be, you know, the money's not been spent over the years, NASA, and, you know, we've not had that kind of intensity. What are these astronauts feeling at the moment? I mean, Trump's talking about, a bit more space goings on. What's your feeling?
Well, what they need to do, of course, is to put the money where their mouths are. There have been plenty of pronouncements about we're going to go back to the moon, we're going to go to Mars, but, you know, these things cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
We need new propulsion systems to go to a place like Mars. But I would say that the upside here is that the commercial space industry is being very innovative. So far, people like Elon Musk are doing what they said they would do, and they're spending the money. They're committed. It's going to take a lot of money. People are going to die because space is unforgiving.
Yeah.
But we might be approaching an inflection point similar to the aviation industry, where, you know, breaking records, flying around the world and so forth. And then you start to get technical standards, it becomes safer, and, you know, pretty soon, you know, you can hop on an airplane and fly anywhere in the world. Well, maybe that's the same glide path that space travel is on today. But like I say, it's going to cost a lot of money, yeah, and people are going to die in the process.
Mm-hmm.
That's the cost of human progress.
Unfortunately, in nearly every field of life, that happens, doesn't it?
Yes.
Well, George, thank you for coming on. Really appreciate your time this afternoon here in Spain. The book's called Calculated Risk, and it's available it's available now from the 30th of September. So, George, thank you for coming on. If you want to order that book, you can. It's on our website, tre.radio. Click on our bookshop banner, and you can order George's book on there. George, many thanks for coming on this afternoon. Really appreciate your time.
Dave, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Lovely. Speak again soon. You take care. Bye-bye now.